The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It's a beautiful Sunday, October 31st, here at WILL AM 580. We're 2 days away from the presidential election, and I think that probably, if I know my listeners well or our listeners well, many of you are thinking about what's going to be happening Tuesday and what it means for the rest of the next 4 years and for our lives in this country and the world. Today, we're really privileged to have as our guest an exceptional journalist, Robert Perry, an award-winning journalist who came to prominence in the 1980s when he broke many of the stories connected with the Iran-Contra affair when working for Associated Press and Newsweek. He now operates an independent news organization called The Consortium. He's the author of several books, including Fooling America, A Look at the Decline of the Washington Press Corps, and Lost History, An Examination of the Hidden History of the Cold War Conflicts in Central America. Robert Perry's newest book is titled Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. It's my pleasure to welcome to our show Bob Perry. Robert, you there?
Yes, I'm here, Bob.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's a privilege to have you on the air with us.
Well, thank you.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your new book, if you would, Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Why did you decide to write this?
Well, that's a good question, I suppose, always, because books are such a painful experience to do. It's my first one in 5 years. Basically, I felt that because I've done so much reporting on the Bush family over the past 25 years or so, I felt there was information that I had that was not particularly well known and certainly not in much circulation in the United States. So the book goes back 30 years, goes back to Watergate, and shows how the two George Bushes have intersected with scandals and other historic events during that period. Simultaneously, the book explains how the country has sort of lost touch with information and reality more and more as we've gone through that period. It describes some of the consequences of Watergate, including the effort by the Republicans and conservatives to build what they considered a counter-establishment, their own infrastructure of media, think tanks, attack groups. That has that began to really gain momentum in the late 70s, picked up a lot of momentum during the Reagan-Bush years of the 80s, kept Clinton on the defensive during the 90s, and then now with the second Bush administration has truly become a dominant force in American politics. And I think it was important to show how that happened while we also watched the Bushes move through this period and how they worked with this group and this infrastructure to consolidate power.
We're talking to Bob Perry today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Bob Perry is the author of the new book, Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. You know, one of the themes in the book, and it's a really detailed history of the Bush family over the past 35 years or so, especially the two Georges who both served as presidents. One of the things that I think is most interesting in it, and there's a lot of interesting stuff in this book, is the term, you know, the notion of the October surprise. This has become a very common theme now. Every 4 years, politicians and journalists talk about a potential October surprise. But the first great October surprise is the one you write about, goes back to 1980. And George Bush the first, George H.W. Bush, was right in the middle of it. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, George Bush actually coined the phrase, at least popularized the phrase, October surprise. And that was in the context of President Carter trying to get out 52 American hostages who were then being held in Iran. There had been an Islamic revolution, one of the first touches of that situation with the United States in Iran in 79, and 52 Americans were seized at the U.S. Embassy. Carter was trying to get them out, trying to negotiate with the Iranians, and George Bush Sr., who was running for vice president at the time in the fall of 1980, coined the phrase October surprise, saying that maybe Carter would use release of the hostages as his October surprise. But the term later became more attached to allegations that behind the scenes, Bush and other Republicans were trying to prevent Carter from getting the hostages out. And the book does spend several chapters describing some startling new evidence that would indicate that indeed the Republicans did try to block the release of the hostages.
Now, if these are extraordinary charges. I mean, that are being made and that the evidence points to. I remember when I first heard about the October surprise during the 1980s, that it was dismissed as lunatic fringe stuff by many people, largely because, if true, I mean, these are treasonous activities to interfere with U.S. foreign policy when trying to get hostages out of a country, and really would really call into jeopardy or call into question the legitimacy of the Reagan election victory in 1980. What has happened since those charges were sort of somewhat dismissed as off the edge in the 1980s to give them more credence today?
Well, I think one has to look at the context of this, of how these efforts have occurred. We go back to 68 even, where we now have a great deal of evidence, in a sense a more serious case, when Richard Nixon and some of his campaign people allegedly, and I think the evidence is now fairly strong that they did, interfere with Lyndon Johnson's efforts to have peace talks with the North Vietnamese in the fall of 1980. The fall of 1968. At the time, there were half a million American troops fighting in Vietnam. So you had this effort by the Nixon campaign to sabotage peace talks by making overtures to the South Vietnamese government to boycott them at a time when hundreds of thousands of American troops were in harm's way. And according to the evidence announced that now it's been pretty well compiled by others mostly, it shows that that this did happen, that the peace talks did collapse, and we went on for four more years of war in Vietnam. So in a sense, by contrast, what happened in 1980 is perhaps less striking. But there was a tremendous sense among the conservatives in the late 1970s that the idea of Jimmy Carter having another term in office was a great threat to national security. He was considered a failure as president by many of the conservatives, and so the idea that they would try to do anything to sort of prevent that was not that far-fetched. Plus, you had a number of people in the U.S. intelligence community who had felt that Carter had damaged the CIA and other intelligence agencies quite badly, and they felt a certain responsibility to see what they could do to prevent Carter from being reelected. So you had a number of forces that came into play in that period, and also the Likud party in Israel was very disturbed by Carter's closeness, closeness to the PLO in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So you had a number of these intersections of interests that made the motive certainly a very strong one for a number of different entities at that time. In addition, we now have a great deal more evidence about from FBI wiretaps that had been placed on one of the suspects' phones. We now have access to. We have documents that were developed by Congress in an investigation that was conducted in the early 1990s, much of which was kept from the American people at the time. But we now have been able to bring that together and show a lot of what happened and how it happened. And I think when you see it in context of this historical sweep, it's not that surprising. It's perhaps, and I felt the same way you did back in when I was working for the AP in 1980. I remember these events happening. And even then, there were some suspicions that something funny was going on because the hostages came out on the day Reagan was inaugurated. And I felt at the time and later that was highly unlikely that there'd be any kind of interference. But the evidence now points in the direction that there was interference.
And what role did George H.W. Bush, the vice presidential candidate in 1980 and father of our current president, play in this October surprise in 1980?
Well, George Bush Sr. had been CIA director in 1976. So he developed some very close relationships at that time with key members of the intelligence community, some of whom lost jobs or were on the outs during the Carter years. A number of them then joined his campaign in 1980. Initially, George Bush was running for president and was running against Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination. And so Bush brought in a significant number of CIA people into American politics in a way they'd never been in American politics before, working on a campaign, and they brought with them a number of their skills. So he was, initially it appears that George Bush Sr. was working with a number of intelligence officers, people like Ted Shackley, who'd been a fairly senior person at the agency, to keep track of what Carter was up to. The initial motivation seems to have been that the Republicans didn't quite know how far Carter was getting with these negotiations and wanted to have their own eyes and ears to find that out. This seems to have merged into contacts with the Iranians that had their, that developed a life of their own. And the Iranians began to see, according to a number of senior officials who've come out of Iran, they began to see this as an effort by the Republicans to develop their own relationship and their own negotiation. So Bush was behind much of that. He was certainly involved in much of it. And there have been allegations which actually have more and more support that he may have personally engaged in contacts with Iranians himself.
We're talking to Robert Perry today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from Urbana, Illinois. This is a live show, so you're welcome to call in if you want to have a question or any comments for Bob Perry to talk about. The number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. The phone lines are open. We welcome your calls. Bob, you said you worked for Associated Press and you also worked for Newsweek back in the 1980s. You are an investigative journalist, but you clearly don't work for them today. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how you support yourself as a journalist today, and then going from your personal story and how you made your transition to sort of the state of investigative journalism in the commercial news media environment today.
Well, I think it's become a lot harder to do investigative journalism over the years. I'm not sure it was a golden age, but it was certainly an age when journalism was more aggressive back in the 1970s. We had, of course, it was the case of the Watergate scandal, which the Post and other publications did a fairly strong job on. There was the work that Cy Hirsch and at the New York Times did on the CIA scandals of the mid to later part of the 70s. The Pentagon Papers were reported in defiance of the government back in that time by the New York Times and other news organizations. And I think that set off an effort by the conservatives and the Republicans in general, who'd seen the Nixon administration destroyed over some of this reporting, to try to counter it. And the efforts included building attack groups like the accuracy and media types that would zero in on individual reporters and news organizations and try to bend them to their will. And that was fairly successful. When we get into the Reagan years, there was also the development of something called public diplomacy or perception management, which was an effort by the Reagan administration to build their own institutions inside the White House and the State Department to put pressure on journalists and bureau chiefs to write about Central America and other issues of that sort in ways that were favorable to the Reagan administration. So you had a lot of pressures being brought to bear on the Washington Press Corps during this period. And I happened to have started, I came to Washington for the AP in 77, in the early part of the Carter years, and worked on the desk and covered economic affairs on the Hill for a while, and was put on their special assignment or investigative team at the end of 1980, and I sort of most stumbled into having to cover much of this. I chose to look at Central America because that was a major issue for the Reagan administration in the early years, and that led me initially to finding more and more information that the way the White House was presenting the case in Central America was not very much in line with the facts in Central America. It was an effort to spin everything, and a very aggressive effort, which then built up in line with this effort to manage the Washington Press Corps more and more aggressively, because there was such a difference between the reality in Central America and how it was being presented in Washington. The Press Corps became sort of was caught in the middle. And so the administration was pretty successful in trying to make the reporters give the case more as the White House wanted it. And so that was the situation that brought us through the 80s. And I was working on stories that became the Iran-Contra scandal, working with Brian Barger at AP. We did the original story about Contra drug trafficking, which actually Senator Kerry, who was then a freshman senator, picked up on and led to his investigation of this problem of Contras in Nicaragua becoming involved in shipping and helping to ship drugs to the United States. So we had this increasingly tense situation where the White House kept insisting things weren't true, and we kept finding out that they were. And the game became, how do you get the American people to not have to hear the stories about what was really happening in Central America? You know, eventually things did explode a bit, and the Iran-Contra story broke, and some of the truth came out. But immediately afterwards, the administration just redoubled its efforts to contain the information and to build firewalls, as Lawrence Walsh, the Independent Counsel, described them, to protect Reagan and Bush. So even as we got to the latter part of the 80s, even after the Iran-Contra scandal, the press continued to degenerate, become weaker and weaker and less willing to stand up to them. And the reasons were pretty obvious. A lot of reporters had lost jobs or had their careers stunted, and the reporters who had played ball were moving ahead. So fairly logically, people followed their self-interest. And that was the mood and the tone that was going on in that period. It made for more and more trouble for people like me trying to go against it.
We're talking to Bob. I'm sorry, Bob. I just want to let folks know we're talking to Robert Perry, author of Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Today on Media Matters, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We welcome phone calls at 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Bob, go ahead and continue with your point, and then we'll get to the phone lines.
Well, I think then we get to through the 1990s. I, at that point, was doing some work for PBS. Frontline, which is when I was sort of roped into doing the original October Surprise work. And then later on, I started my own website, the consortium, consortiumnews.com, which we started in 95 because there was so much important information that was now documentable that was there was just no interest in it. By the mid-90s, people all they wanted to write about was Bill Clinton's sex life. And if you were going back and talking about some historical events of the 80s and early 90s, people just didn't seem to care. So we decided to use the Internet as in that early phase, back in 95, where the first sort of investigative magazine that was put up on the Internet, and it was to get out some of these stories. I did that for a number of, for the rest of the 90s, and by 2000, we're running out of money, so I took a job as an editor at Bloomberg News and ran their staff covering the SEC and securities regulations, and did that until a few months ago when I left to do this book.
You know, I'm struck, Bob, you mentioned that in the 1980s when you were working on the story on Central America, how Senator Kerry, then a freshman senator from Massachusetts, read the piece, was struck by it, and launched what are now fairly famous Senate hearings on the subject. Morton Mintz, one of the well-known Washington reporters, longstanding, had a comment in a conversation recently where he said, you know, one of the real problems facing investigative journalism today is that the political system's gotten so corrupt that it used to be if you broke a big story that exposed something, there would usually be political consequences. People in power would be forced to do something about it. Now you can break a big story and it sort of gets, you know, put under the rug and nothing happens. And because of that, journalists have less incentive to break a story because it doesn't seem to have much of an effect. And owners, certainly, and editors are less inclined to want to do the work because they don't see the importance of it.
Well, I think Morton's right, except it also works the other way. And this was certainly true of the Kerry case. Senator Kerry did this very courageous investigation. He really went up against the Reagan-Bush administration at the height of its power, starting in early 86, before Iran-Contra broke. And he was not only on top of the problem of the drug trafficking by the Contras, which was a serious scandal, but he was also picking up information, as we were at AP, on Oliver North's secret operations to support the Contras. But he went through that. Most of the media at this point had been pretty much brought to heel, so he was treated very hostily. Certainly, the conservative press, the Washington Times type operations, attacked him, but also the New York Times and the Washington Post. Essentially attacked his work.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he came out with his report in 89 describing in remarkable detail that the U.S. government had been looking the other way and tolerating drug trafficking being brought into the United States for foreign policy reasons, he was treated with disdain by the major media. All the stories were very brief. They were buried inside the papers. Newsweek, in a conventional wisdom watch, referred to Kerry as a Randy conspiracy buff because of his work on the topic. And it wasn't really vindicated until 1998, almost a decade later, when the CIA did its internal investigation of these allegations, done by the Inspector General. And the Inspector General, Frederick Hitz, confirmed virtually everything that Kerry had said. Hmm. And put out a report in two volumes in 1998, and it was widely ignored then. So mm-hmm. the press corps did not want to go back and re-examine how they had bungled one of the most important scandals of the period. So it works both ways. Mm-hmm. The times that politicians have done good work, and even in the case of the CIA putting out this report, and the press corps has not had the guts to really dig into it and actually read the reports and develop stories off them. So you have it working both ways.
You're listening to Bob Perry, the guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Bob Perry is the author of the new book, Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. If you call, I guarantee I'll get to you. And let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Robert Perry.
Yes, I have just a couple of questions to ask. One regards Greg Palast and his work regarding the 2000 Florida election. I see what you're saying about the 1980 election. We all had our suspicions regarding that at the time. But since then, as you obviously correctly pointed out, there, on the one hand, there's been this direct intervention by the Bushes and those connected with them in many cases in elections as well as in the media, 1988 being one example with Willie Horton, the use of various innuendos and so on. And of course, at the same time, the increasing tabloidization of the news since roughly the O.J. Simpson trial. And what I see is, on the one hand, this sort of direct intervening in elections as well as in the media. At the same time, there's been this relativization of the news on such a level that when Greg Palast goes to CBS and others in the 2000 election, nothing happens. And to this day, I find it remarkable that even though it's in the public sphere, none of the major news outlets really take this seriously. And I just wonder what you think of his work and what he found out about the 2000 election.
Well, I think what Greg found out about the so-called felon list was quite remarkable and a very important story.
Could you give a little bit, just so listeners might not be familiar with that, to explain what that means?
Well, after the election in 2000, when there was, of course, this long recount in Florida, Greg Palast, who was doing work for the BBC, he's an American journalist, but he could only find outlets overseas, broke this important story that there had been this felon list that had been misapplied. In other words, that while purging ex-felons from Florida's rolls, this list also threw out a lot of other people who had similar names or similar birthdays or things of that sort, which impacted fairly most seriously on African Americans in Florida. So you had this effort to purge these people and stop them from voting when they showed up at the polls in November of 2000. Now this should be a fairly serious story, and it was well documented, well supported. But in the climate that we were faced with in 2000, the major American media shunned it. It really took months. It wasn't until after the recount had been sort of cut off, after Bush was inaugurated, that the Washington Post and other news organizations came and wrote about what Palast had been writing about in real time. But what it shows is that there's this tremendous fear on the part of the Washington press corps to take on the Republicans and the conservatives. The price reporters pay is so high, and the risks are so great for your career that people stop doing it.
You know, Bob, if I can interject here, two things. First of all, you talk about the 2000 election in Secrecy and Privilege. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about what you get at in your book concerning the Bush family and the Florida election 2000. And secondly, could you also just talk about what you think some of the key issues journalists are downplaying or soft peddling or even ignoring right now of importance concerning the Bush family and conservative Republicans that they don't want the public to know about?
Well, I think we had this probably the culmination of all I was writing about, really the culmination from Watergate, is Iraq. And the reason I did this 30-year sweep is I think if you look at it over three decades, you see how these different aspects developed, how the Bush family weaved into this, how the conservatives built this infrastructure, how the press was attacked, how also, by the way, the CIA's analytical division was attacked really starting in the late 70s and early 80s by when Bush was the CIA director in 76, but then more aggressively when Reagan and Bush take over in 1981. So you see this sort of assault really on the information base of the United States. The American people get less and less truth because the people who are responsible for providing it, particularly in the case of the government, the CIA's analytical division, and the National Press Corps, are under assault, under organized assault, to try to silence them. And I think we go through this period, and when you get to the period of the second Bush administration, the CIA analytical division is pretty much a conveyor belt of disinformation, or pretty much whatever the White House wants to hear, they deliver. You know, Dick Cheney, the vice president, was going over to Langley and sitting down with these core analysts who had seen a previous generation of analysts wiped out, and he's telling them basically, why can't you see these weapons of mass destruction, or couldn't these photographs be of WMD? And these guys are seeing their careers pass before their eyes, so they're basically going along with it. And in the press corps, we had a similar phenomenon. So when you get to this point, no one of significant influence in the National Press Corps was willing to challenge the case on Iraq. Mm-hmm. And we saw this across the board. And when people did write some stories, people like Walter Pincus, sort of an older reporter, you know, old traditional reporter for the Washington Post, his stories were being buried inside. So, but on the front page, the Washington Post was running pretty much whatever Bush and Cheney would say about it. So you had this remarkable case where the United States, the American people, were being misled into a war. And now we know that because the facts on the ground ultimately came out. But how we got there is still a remarkable tale of failure across the board. And I think what we've seen is, if we understand how it all happened, which is what the point of in a way of secrecy and privilege is, I think we would then get a sense of how we have to approach it and how we have to correct it. And I think that's the main point of the book, beyond the fact of how the Bushes fit into that process.
You're listening to Bob Perry today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Robert Perry is the author of Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. We've got a full bank of callers, and I promise I'm going to get to all of you, so please be patient. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Robert Perry.
Hi. I'm calling because you were talking about Kerry taking on the Reagan-Bush administration with his investigation that you mentioned earlier. And a lot of people I've talked to, you know, kind of left-leaning, kind of vote for Kerry, but very nervous about him, you know, many things, but primarily of him sweeping the corruption of the past 4 years under the rug. It's terribly ironic. I see it happening. I guess I'd like Mr. Perry's comments on that, and what we can do as citizens to ensure that just doesn't happen. And, you know, there's a whole media side of this question that goes on along with that. Maybe you can address that as well. Thanks.
Well, thank you. You know, if I can add to that, Bob, before you answer it, I mean, there's a lot of people, I think, like that caller. The suspicion is that John Kerry peaked in the late 80s. You know, since then, he hasn't followed it up with a number of similar sort of examinations or willingness to take on the powerful, that he's sort of more of a team player with the Washington consensus inside the Beltway crowd. What's your sense?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think John Kerry has always been a sort of two minds. One is the rebel, going off and just doing what he thinks is right, and the other is to be part of the establishment, part of the team. And I think he's been torn by those two pressures or two motivations throughout his career. But I think that's typical of politicians. I think any politician that is who doesn't have that sense of there are limits of how far I can go is pretty well is not going to go very far and not survive long in American politics, at least not in national politics.
Well, what can citizens do to follow up on that question? If they're concerned, sort of keep the assuming Kerry is elected, a big assumption, but assuming he is, to make the last 4 years part of the public record, and if people have broken laws, to make them accountable.
Well, I think there are a couple things. One is that my view of politicians is that some of them do want to do the right thing, but they're only willing to go as far as they feel is politically safe. If there is more of a mass movement, if there's a stronger media, for instance, independent media that is bringing these issues to bear and making and rallying the public around them, then I think it's easier for politicians to do more. If they feel that if they try to do something like Kerry tried to do in investigating the serious scandal of the U.S. government allowing drug traffickers to move cocaine into the United States over a several-year period, and he tried to stop it, he tried to blow the whistle on it, and all he got for that was to be ridiculed in the National Press Corps, that's gonna cause a politician to pull back.
It's the chilling effect, they call that.
Chilling effect, and it works the same for reporters. As you point out from Martin Mintz's comment, if a reporter feels there's no upside, there's no gain personally for doing the right thing and going off after these hard stories, most reporters aren't going to do it. And I think that's true of most politicians. So it's, to some degree, it's up to the American people to create more of a climate where they are demanding that these kinds of issues be dealt with and that they are supporting people who try to do it.
And well, we're talking to Bob Perry today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a full bank of callers. I want to get to you all. Before I do, though, I'd like to let you all know that in the coming weeks, our guests here on Media Matters will include Norman Solomon, Tariq Ali, Janine Jackson, and Paul Krugman. So that's the upcoming lineup here on Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's go to another caller now. Line 3, calling from the highways of Illinois. You're on the air with Robert Perry.
Hello. It baffles me. I mean, I am not a native-born American, but it baffles me because I don't understand why Americans are not interested in information or being skeptical observers of information. I come from Nigeria originally, and I just don't understand. Because, I mean, my dream of America was not what I've come to know. And I don't know. I'm baffled.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling. Bob, this is an issue that I get hit with all the time as a professor and someone who writes about media on issues. People are concerned, is the state of our journalism today a reflection of audience demand? Is it the people just simply don't care and are ignorant and are happy, blissful in their ignorance? Or is that the primary problem we face today, do you think?
Well, that's a tough question. It's the chicken egg issue, but I think there is a curiosity among the American people. They would like better information. They're just not getting it. And what do they do about it? I think there's a feeling of helplessness, if you will, when you want to know facts and when these stories are hard to assemble on the part of for the journalists. It's difficult for the journalists to get the stories together and out through what's available now as news outlets, and then I think the people would respond if they got them, but since they're not getting them, they have to put up with what they have. I think there is a great deal of dissatisfaction across the country about what people see on television and what they read in the newspapers. They feel they're being misled. And I do think there's a huge market out there, as we've seen with some programs, even like Comedy Central's The Daily Show, which does a sort of more satire of the news, but it has struck a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
People are looking at the press corps with a great deal more skepticism than they ever have.
We're talking to Bob Perry. Let's go back to the phone lines. Urbana, you're on the air with Robert Perry. Hello, Urbana.
Yes, hello, Bob.
Hi.
I enjoy your program, and I listen to it most Sundays. And one of the things that I'm very concerned about in journalism is fair balance. And it seems to me as though while I very much enjoy your intellect and what you're providing on Sundays, it's always more than slightly tilted to the left, both from the guests that you bring on your program to your commentary yourself. And I would like you to comment on that and to see if it's my being myopic of what you're saying. And as for your guest, what about doing some investigative reporting on the oil for food scandal that seems to be overlooked by the press, because they certainly by the left press, they don't want to seem to get involved in that. And thank you for taking my question.
Certainly. Thank you. Well, you know, let's go directly to the second part there, if we can, Bob, because I know when I've had you as a guest on my show years ago and I did the show in Madison, Wisconsin, this very issue came up. And as I recall, you recoiled at the idea that you were being a partisan. I mean, I think you regard yourself as a fairly indiscriminate critical journalist. Do you shade your work by political party or ideology?
No, I don't. There is a problem that has developed, though, where if you have one side, in the case, I think it's true of the present administration, the Bush administration, they've shown a disdain for information. If you've got that happening, and I think it's clear from what's happened in Iraq, there has been a disdain for information. Journalists are supposed to stand up for information. And if one side wants to play that game, and not that the other side doesn't too, to some degree, but if one is really pushing the edges of it, reporters can't just sort of try to get themselves in the middle. You have to try to stand up for the facts and the truth, and if people want to get mad about that, they have a right to. And it is true that there are a lot of stories that deserve more attention. I would agree with that too. I think how the UN managed the Food for Peace program is a legitimate issue, and people are looking into it. I know Volcker is a former Fed chairman. Volcker is investigating it, and I think people will follow it. But that doesn't change that there has been a strong effort, which I think understandably comes out of Republican and conservative anger about Watergate back in the mid-70s and about the defeat in Vietnam, to go after the National Press Corps and to try to bring them to heel. And I think that's an important historical event. And if that's not a conservative or liberal thing, really. It is. I think it's an historical fact. And I think we have to look at it and see how what it's done to the country.
Yeah, and I'll just simply say that this show is perceived of as a chance to get voices like Robert Perry that are not widely heard otherwise in our news media available to the listeners of East Central Illinois, and to allow them to really have a chance to ask questions directly like the caller just did, and not really a chance for me to stand on a soapbox. People interested in my views have plenty of opportunities to hear them elsewhere. So I'm more like, this is a dating service I'm operating between people like Bob's Perry and the listeners of the community. Let's go back to the phone lines if we can. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Robert Perry.
Hey, I'm all in favor of hearing more voices. I just want to mention that I believe that secrecy is antithetical to democracy, and I also believe that Republicans and Democrats have strong interests in protecting secrecy and the military-industrial complex. Michael Rupert, I guess he's discredited now that Bin Laden has admitted that he's responsible behind the 9/11 attacks, but he's brought up a lot of questions, and he has said that there are two views about Kerry's role in the Iran-Contra investigations. And he says that while one view is that Kerry did a laudable job, there's another view that says that he actually did a masterful job of keeping some of the most damaging Iran-Contra secrets hidden. I wonder if Mr. Perry would maybe address that argument and explain why it does not or does hold up, or whether there's some truth in it.
All right. Thank you very much, caller.
Well, I think what the evidence now shows is that the Kerry investigation was being stonewalled by the Reagan-Bush administration. And this came out, if one goes back to the HITS report, the CIA's internal report, what we see is that information that Kerry was seeking was being denied him. When he was asking about certain Contra-connected figures who were implicated in the drug trade, the CIA withheld information about what the CIA knew about their drug involvement. So I think what we see is that Kerry's investigation was being obstructed. Whether or not there were punches pulled, it's always hard to say. There are times when I think a politician trying to do a responsible report will be very conservative or cautious in terms of how he approaches evidence because he doesn't want to overreach. And in this case, Kerry was being denied information that could have helped make his report stronger. So I don't know. I think the evidence I have in front of me would suggest that Kerry's investigation went probably as far as it could based on what was known at the time. It turns out that the picture of the Contra drug story and where it reached and how it reached into the CIA and into the White House even was worse than what Kerry presented. But I'm not sure that's his fault, that he didn't get to everything.
This is Bob Perry. You're listening to Today Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. It's coming to you live from Urbana, Illinois. Let's go back to our phone lines. Line 3, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Yeah, the great treachery of the October surprise from 80 is, the denial that's already out there about whatever's going on now. I mean, it's really hard to break through, it seems to me. And I don't want to ask you to comment on two other journalists again, but point out that Adnan Khashoggi, who you wrote about in the Iran-Contra days as a bagman for the money to Iran, he stays around and he's on the board of Barrick Gold with George H.W. Bush. It's amazing that story just, of corporate cronyism can't break through. But from 77, which was the year of the intelligence, I've just been Googling Carl Bernstein and CIA. He wrote a piece for Rolling Stone about how Senior Bush helped cover up, it was part of the story of how much CIA infiltration into the overseas press corps was important, and that Bush was pivotal in stemming that tide. I don't know if you treat that, but when you Google it, you don't get any mainstream references to it at all, not even academic or scholastic references. It's all sort of this growth. Don't get anything from Consortium News on it either, which I haven't heard you pitch your website, which is quite excellent. I have heard you talk about Lee Hamilton actually as having more pivotal role in the cover-up of Iran-Contra and not pursuing anything after the fact. And it's interesting to note that you also mention him as it's probably why he was a likely choice for the 911 commission. Now that's just much too much, and for the next couple of minutes, so I'll hang up and see what you parse out of it. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. You know, Robert, we should do a better job of pushing your book, which we've been talking about, Secrecy and Privilege: Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. If listeners are interested in finding a copy of the book or learning more about it, what can they do?
Well, probably the best way is to go to the website that's dedicated for it, which is www.secrecyandprivilege.com. People can read about it more there or order if they'd like. As far as the caller's questions, I think they're good ones. It is true that in 1976, when George H.W. Bush was director of the Central Intelligence Agency, he played a very important role in bringing the scandals of the CIA under control, in effect, sweeping many of them under the rug. And that was basically his assignment from President Ford, who was running for election in 76 and was concerned about the impact of all these scandals spilling out of the agency. So Bush was brought in with his gold-plated credentials and connections to see what he could do to get the CIA off the front pages, as Bush put it at the time. So we saw that we saw Bush being fairly successful, and there was one actually very serious case that came up in 76, which was the assassination of Letelier, who was a former Chilean foreign minister, and he was killed on the streets of Washington along with an American woman co-worker. And the CIA knew almost from the very beginning, this was in September of 76, that the Chilean government was implicated. But that was, and there would have been a huge embarrassment at the time. It would have probably damaged Ford's campaign. Bush swept it under the rug. He sent reporters off on wrong directions. He claimed that the evidence was against the involvement of the Chilean government, and it took a year or two after Bush left office for the Chilean government to be shown to be responsible for the assassination. And then you see people like Lee Hamilton reappearing throughout this, throughout a number of these investigations, and often playing the same role, which is to take a very cautious, very uninquisitive approach toward finding out the truth. He did this initially with when we started reporting about Norris operations in 85 and 86. He was head of the Intelligence Committee, and he led the group, which included Dick Cheney and Henry Hyde. He led the Intelligence Committee over to the White House. They sat down with Oliver North in the Situation Room and asked North if our story, which had 24 sources, was true. And North said it wasn't, as did Admiral Poindexter, the National Security Advisor, and a couple other people. And that was the end of the investigation. It wasn't until other events occurred in the fall of 86 that the Iran-Contra scandal spilled out. But it wasn't because Lee Hamilton had done done a good investigation. And that was it, and that became a recurring pattern for him. And I think it was why he was picked for the 9/11 commission, that he wouldn't go too far with it.
And let's talk for a second. We have a couple of callers I want to get to before we end the show. But let's quickly talk about the 9/11 commission. What was your sense of that, the caliber of investigation that constituted, and then also how the press covered the report of the 9/11 commission?
Well, I think the commission did a pretty good job assembling a lot of facts. And things that we didn't really know as a country, or that had not been highlighted, because there was such an effort after the terrorist attack to not divide the country, to not be too critical of President Bush at the time. So a lot of information, including the fact that he essentially froze after the attacks occurred, was swept under the rug, was not reported particularly. And it did not get focused on again until the 9/11 Commission and, of course, Michael Moore's movie. But I think overall they did a pretty good job bringing a lot of facts together, but they did pull their punches in drawing conclusions. They did not want to blame anybody. And I'm not quite sure what the point of an investigation like that is if you can't say this person slipped up here and that person slipped up there. It seems it's almost useless. But that's what they chose to do.
And do you think the media did an accurate job portraying the contents of what they came up with?
I think the press corps has done a better job since the Iraq case has sort of blown up in its face. I think the embarrassment of being so wrong on the weapons of mass destruction has pushed the New York Times and the Washington Post into doing a more skeptical and critical job. So I think overall there's been improvement in terms of how some of these stories have been reported in the last year or so.
We're talking to Bob Perry today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Robert Perry is the author of the brand new book, Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. To learn more about the book, go to www.secrecyandprivilege.com. And you can also check out the work that he does as an investigative journalist at www.consortiumnews.com, consortiumnews.com. You know, if you sign up for the Media Matters weekly emailing list we have, we'll send you all those links. You won't have to write them down. We'll send you one email a week with all the background information on the guests of the show and a link to the archive of all our old programs. All you need to do is email our producer, Victor Picard, at vpickard@uiuc.edu. We'll get you on the list. You can get off whenever you want. We have one more caller who's been waiting faithfully. Let's go to those lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Robert Perry.
Yeah, I recently heard Chomsky say that half the working-age men of Nicaragua are working in Costa Rica. And I don't know if that's a legacy of the Contras or not, but I actually have a question about something else. There's been a lot of commentary about how Carter's not been able to monitor this election because our presidential election doesn't meet his standards. And I was curious, do you think Carter is keeping the CIA from fixing elections down in Latin America with his poll monitoring or not? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I know enough to judge all of what the Carter Center has done in terms of monitoring elections. Generally, when I've been on the scene with them, they seem to have done a fairly good job. You know, I've been in, you know, Haiti and in Central America, and I think overall it's probably it's helpful, but I really don't know enough in terms of the details of what they've done around the world.
You know, it is striking what the caller was referring to. I guess the Carter Center has a handful of criteria that countries have to meet before they will consider monitoring an election. sort of baseline democratic criteria to have to be there to even have the semblance of a fair election. And I gather, according to President Carter, the United States doesn't meet some of these criteria at present, so it would not qualify as a country that they could monitor the election in.
Well, it's all very disturbing, and certainly it's been increasingly disturbing when there's evidence that's emerged about efforts to suppress the vote of American citizens. There are a lot of foreign observers now coming to the United States. The OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, has a delegation here, and there are really thousands of people monitoring American elections, and it's somewhat embarrassing, quite frankly, I think for the American people to have their elections, which were considered the gold standard, be now considered not of of international standards.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
that
I
seems to be the case.
I recall, as I'm sure anyone who's over the age of like 15 recalls, that until 2000, the concern on election day was, well, we know the outcome by 4 in the afternoon, so no one on the West Coast will have any incentive to vote. Now the question is, you know, how many weeks will it take till we know the outcome?
Right. But the efforts to discourage Americans from voting it goes against so much that those of us of perhaps a bit older than 15 would just find shocking. And not that it didn't happen. I mean, there were cases back, certainly back to the 60s, we certainly know of the controversy around Mr. Rehnquist, now the Chief Justice, where he was allegedly involved in voter suppression in Arizona. And going back to Jim Crow in the efforts in the South to hold down the African-American vote. But for those kinds of residual activities to be continuing to this day is quite troubling, I think, to many Americans.
Robert Pear, we've only got a minute or so left. What sort of stories are you looking to be working on in the coming months? What's catching your attention?
Well, I think how this election turns out will be important. I think how the vote goes in terms of whether it's a fair election. Obviously, we'll keep track of that and keep an eye on what we can regarding that. But overall, I think if Kerry were to win, the issue would then become, can we go back over the past 4 years and back really over the last quarter century and get the information together that would give the American people a coherent history of what's happened, how we got where we are. You know, secrecy and privilege was a stab at doing what I could, but I think there's so much more that needs to be done. And I think if Americans understood what happened over the last 25 years or so, they'd be able to figure out what could be done to make it better.
On that note, Robert Perry, I want to thank you very much for being my guest today on Media Matters. Robert Perry is the author of Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. You can find out about it at secrecyandprivilege.com. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
And I want to thank my producer, Victor Picard, for his usual terrific job arranging the guests and producing the show. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I'll be back 167 hours with Norman Solomon to talk about the election. In the meantime, hope you all vote. Take care.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Devro Teapag in Danville, Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur, EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont, and Citizen Sandwich and Convenience, Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high in the mid-60s and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, a chance of light rain in the evening, then rain likely after midnight. The low in the upper 40s with east winds around 5 miles per hour this evening, increasing to 10 to 15 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, rain likely with the high in the upper 50s and east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at will.uiuc.edu. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.